publishing and book selling aren't industries that immediately conjure up images of rebellion. Well, sometimes, actually. In 1970, Penguin Books Australia took a radical decision which upturned over 70 years' worth of censorship legislation. The publishing of Philip Roth's Portnoy's Complaint shook the Australian censorship laws to their foundations and started a landslide of societal change. Patrick Mullins is an Australian historian of odd figures already. His first book, Tiberius with a Telephone, was a biography of the ill-fated Australian Prime Minister William McMahon. It came out in 2018 and won the New South Wales Premier's Award for Literature. He's following it up with The Trials of Portnoy, about the saga of the publishing of Philip Roth's novel and the cast-iron response of the government of the day. Patrick, welcome to Nine to Noon.
Thanks for having me, Catherine.
There are some very, very high-profile examples, of course, of tales of forbidden books that were immensely popular and how they changed societies. We don't necessarily associate Australia with them, however, and yet this is one of the great such stories, isn't it?
It is. It's in many respects kind of an Australian version of the Lady Shatterley trials in the UK. It's a moment of quite seminal change, both in how literature is treated and understood, but also in the rights and freedoms that we get from these kind of battles.
Was it a good book?
Look, there might be some people who say no, but it can't be denied that Portnoy's Complaint is certainly Philip Roth's. It was the book that launched him into the stratosphere, so to speak. You know, it sold 400,000 copies. It was made very quickly into a film. He was able to build a pool out of it. And it obviously changed things in Australia. So it must have been a bit good, at least.
Was it the self-pleasuring or the abuse of a piece of liver that most set the stencils off?
You'd have to say it's a combination of both. Both of these, the language and the use of sex in the book were the features that really the censors took most umbrage with, and that was the basis for their reason for not bringing it into Australia, for disallowing it. But simultaneously, that discussion of sex, that really frank discussion of the taboo, was something that was actually going to be quite a catalyst, because debates around sex and about autonomy were rife in Australia at this time. So it was kind of, on one hand, just the sex alone, but it was also the issues that it fed into. It was kind of the door to bigger issues.
Not only sex, but an underlying theme of onanism. Oh, how many warm words can I come up with it? and was that particularly taboo? There are some religious and social cohorts who seem to get particularly upset about the idea of pleasuring oneself.
Yes, absolutely. That's been a taboo issue right throughout. And in Australia, certainly the treatment of masturbation and discussion of it it pops up in all sorts of books, from Ulysses to Lady Shatterley's Lover. And, of course, they're always seized upon and derided as perversions and filth and things that no God-fearing person should want to read and should be protected from as well. That's the feature that became notorious about Portnoy's Complaint. It was advertised as the funniest novel you've ever read about sex. And there were quite a lot of people who argued, in fact, during the trials of Anne Portnoy, that the autonomy that is required to masturbate was something that would actually lead people to disobey their parents and to disobey government. And coming at a time when there were protests over Australia's participation in Vietnam and over protests about women's rights and Indigenous rights, that concept of autonomy, it fed into it. I know that's a big leap, but it did feed into it.
Solipsism was sort of the concept, wasn't it? That if you were this sort of self-absorbed on a regular basis, it might affect your character more broadly.
Absolutely. And Alexander Portnoy is derided and damned for that very thing. The prosecutors who took on this novel were saying that Portnoy is this depraved and corrupted figure, and he's a pervert, and he will deprave and corrupt you as well because he is so self-obsessed. But this became the defending point, in fact, for quite a number of the defence counsel and defence witnesses, who said that he is this kind of depraved figure. He is this pitiful figure. He is this self-absorbed figure who can't make connections. So on one hand, you might say he's a pervert. Defense would say as well, he's also somebody who's quite lonely and isolated, and that this book is not to celebrate him and to celebrate those acts, but actually to show that there's a moral here that we need to explore and need to understand in order to, you know, rehabilitate this man.
It's 1970. Before we get back to the history, the particular history of censorship in Australia, it is a time, isn't it, where it's not dissimilar to today, actually. There is a sense of a sort of an epochal shift of things giving way to new things and old things holding on for dear life. How would you describe Australia in 1970 when this all happened?
Right at the hinge point of change. Right at the hinge point of change. At this time, the Liberal Country Party government, which had been in power for 23 years, was beginning to totter toward defeat. It would come in 1972. Protests over Australia's participation in Vietnam were gaining a lot of force and momentum. There were debates and highlights around discrimination and around racism, around land rights for Australia's Indigenous people. And there were consistent debates around gender and women's rights and discrimination in the workplace. So this was a moment and a time of huge change. And it's generally seen in that light. And censorship is bound up in all of that. It becomes, in some ways, the gateway for a discussion of these issues about the role of the family, about autonomy, about freedom. And Portnoy's complaint, in many respects, at a broader level as well, Portnoy's complaint and its publication by Penguin Books speaks to Australian literature and an Australian literary scene, because at this time, domestic Australian publishing was actually beginning to grow. Until this point, most Australian authors published first in London and then had their books sent to Australia. But in the 1960s and into the 1970s, Australian publishers were taking on Australian books and publishing them first here in the country, deliberately trying to influence the future and its culture.
Let's look at the history. I'm just recalling some of the books actually here that were going through similar trials, perhaps not as dramatic as this. I'm just going to look some of them up. They're in my memory, but I'm going to check them before I raise them. It was a very tumultuous time around, as we said, a certain set of societal standards giving way to what everyone basically wanted to read. let's go back to where the story of censorship begins, though, because we go right back to the early 20th century. There was some pretty strict legislation even from the end of the 19th century. So we're going back to not the very earliest years, but still some fairly early years in modern Australian history. Well, who was doing the legislating?
So the first censorship laws were passed in the colonies in Australia. So Sydney in New South Wales, in Queensland, Victoria. And they were basically passing various drafts of imperial statutes around obscenity. So they were passing material to prevent the distribution of this stuff in Australia. And when Australia federated, those colonial laws were inherited by the states and became the domestic censorship system. And the idea was that you'd be able to basically root out anything that you thought was obscene or indecent. And that was a huge swathe of stuff, from anything that might be realistic, that might, you know, use realism to depict adultery or depict matters of sex. But it also was quite expansive and just touched on abortion and contraception, scientific publications that showed, how to abort a baby or stuff. That stuff was policed and was plucked out, extracted. The idea behind all of this, though, was that Australia was this kind of new country. It was an outpost of the British Empire. And it needed to be kept pure. It needed to be kept clean from that kind of moral contamination. And that became both a self-policing idea, in the sense of the domestic censorship system, and it became a quarantine system as well. When Australia federated, the federal government passed the Customs Act, which allowed clerks in the Customs Department to open all shipments on the wharf or on the runway, and they'd police, they'd go through your bags and they'd find any books you've got and they'd toss them out if they thought they were, not right to keep bringing into Australia. So it was this idea of keeping Australia homogenous and keeping it clean and keeping it pure. So anything obscene or indecent relating to sex, that was tossed out. Anything that was blasphemous, so anything that contravened ideas of God, a Christian God in particular, and anything as well that might be politically dangerous. So anything that advocated sedition, fascism, socialism, anarchism, you know, all of these were this kind of literature was policed and tossed out. And it's really easy to connect this system, to see it within the guise of with racial dimensions and class dimensions. The old definition of what was obscene and indecent was that it had to be material that had tendency to deprave and corrupt those whose minds are open to such immoral influences. And that category, those minds that are open, was extended from children to women to the poor to the uneducated to people of colour. And the books that were bound up in that, were caught up in that, often were ones that, you know, portrayed people of lower classes or which would appeal to people of the lower and working classes. So books like Lady Chatterley's Lover, for example, where you have a groundskeeper who has an affair with a married woman of noble birth, that's obviously contravenes that, and that's part of the reason why it was banned. Another book that was a problem for the censors was Another Country by James Baldwin, which depicts homosexuality and depicts interracial relationships. And so that was a no-go. That was an absolute no-no. And so that book too was banned. But the censorship system really, you know, it was there from Federation, and it became at its most severe and most conspicuously severe in the 1920s and 30s, when works of modernism, particularly things like Hemingway's Farewell to Arms or Aldous Huxley's Brave New World or James Joyce's Ulysses, when those books were published and they were banned because they advocated and portrayed ideas and people and characters that the censors just would have no truck with. It was a resurgence of it in the 1950s with books like Forever Amber and into the 1960s with books like The Group, Lolita, Myra Breckinridge by Gore Vidal. Even James Bond, The Spy Who Loved Me, was banned at one point in Australia. So it's a lot of books that get banned. And well, it's this
more
kind
so
of...
than other countries, because again, we're familiar with many of these testing censors in other countries. Mm. More so in Australia? Was it stricter than you might have found elsewhere?
Absolutely, absolutely. Australia was nicknamed the Island of the South Pacific, because that's who we rivaled, you know, Ireland and maybe South Africa for some of these titles. So we were stricter. And one of the really interesting things about this is that, in fact, even though we had, you know, tried to copy the British and by adopting their statutes and their ideas, we actually regarded ourselves very quickly as being purer than the British. In the early 1900s, we were going to sign a treaty with them about obscene and indecent material, and our government actually hesitated. They thought, the British, they actually produce a lot of this filth. They produce a lot of this material. We don't want it. Maybe we don't want parity with these people. Maybe we want to keep ourselves cleaner because we were stricter.
All right. When did the real resistance to censorship begin to build?
So the first manifestation of it was in the 1930s. But the thing about the opposition to censorship was that it often went in ebbs and flows. There would be some opposition would centre on a certain book, spotlight and public attention would fall onto that book, customs would back down and the opposition would fall away. And then as things were quiet, customs would go back to its old ways. It really started to garner steam, though, in the 1960s. Really conspicuous banning and really kind of mind-bogglingly dumb decisions, farcical decisions in some ways. Caught a lot of public attention. When Lady Chatterley's Lover, for example, was released in the United Kingdom and allowed to go free, Australia's government said, no, we're still not going to have it. And then Penguin Books published a transcript of the court trial of Lady Chatterley's Lover to highlight and honour the role that was played there. And the Australian government said, we're not going to have that book either. You know, we're going to ban a court transcript. And this was one of the kind of models for what Penguin did with Portnoy's complaint. Three Sydney-based men had a copy of the trial of Lady Chatterley's Lover torn up, folded into letters, posted into Australia, reassembled it, they typeset their own edition, and they printed it and published it in secret. And this forced the federal government to back down and remove the ban on the book. And that became kind of the model that Penguin Books followed on a much larger scale with Portnoy. But the censorship system was also coming under attack in the domestic sense as well. the editors of a student magazine called Oz, for example, were tried for obscenity on two occasions. And on the second occasion, they were actually sentenced to 6 months hard labour, this kind of ridiculous decision that was overturned on appeal. But it drew a lot of attention to censorship again. The next big one that came along was by Wendy Bacon, who was the student editor of the student university magazine Thurunka, who started printing obscenities and four-letter words and all this kind of material in the student paper with a deliberate aim of clogging up the courts, of saying, if this stuff is so bad, try us for every single one and we will drag this out. We will make you look like fools. And she did this quite successfully. So the censorship system in the 1960s and into the 1970s was coming under sustained attack at a state level and at a federal level as well. And when Portnoy's complaint came along, partly because it was a work of quite clear literary merit and popular acclaim, but also because it drew on these obscenities and these four-letter words and these tropes of pornography, it kind of was able to strike it at all the foundations of that system at the same time.
What was happening politically? Like, there's the censorship system, and was it still federal and state in charge of different aspects of censorship, by the way, one international, one local, or had that changed?
No, that's how it was going.
Yeah.
The big change that had happened in 1968 was that the federal government had agreed with the states that there would be uniform censorship, that if one of them banned it, everyone had to ban it. So the idea was to stop books coming in via different state lines.
Smuggled across borders.
Exactly. That's it.
Wonderful.
Midnight exchanges. But the issue that had happened in 1969 was the Federal Labor Party, the main opposition party in to the government, had reformed its policies on censorship. And it said, from now on, if we get into government, we're going to change censorship to accord with the idea that if you're an adult, you can read what you want. And if you're under 18, if you're not an adult, then you'll be protected from that material. So, you know, we'll screen it, basically. We'll classify this material as being suitable for certain age groups. And once you're 18, that cuts out and you can read whatever you want. The Liberal Party government, however, would have no truck with that. It said, we understand firm. But at the same time, a new government minister in the person of Don Chipp was appointed, who regarded censorship as something inherently illogical and undesirable. That's the phrase he used for it. And Chipp started to modernise and liberalise the censorship system to some extent. He let some books that, you know, were older and that had kind of fallen by the wayside, I suppose, he began to allow those books into Australia. So Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer, for example. But on Portnoy's complaint, he stood firm, and the Liberal Party country government stood firm, and in the states as well, those states governed by the Liberal Country Party, which was every single one of them except for South Australia, also said they would stand firm. South Australia, which was run by a Labor government under Don Dunstan, was going to align itself with the Labor Party position of allowing you to read anything you want if you're over 18.
Well, well. Patrick Mullins, our guest. We're talking about his latest book, The Trials of Portnoy, all about this huge censorship battle that came to a head around the publishing of Philip Roth's Portnoy's Complaint. 25 minutes past 10 it is. You're listening to 9 to Noon. So then what happens when Portnoy's complaint is published? February 1969. First of all, it sells like hotcakes, right?
So the book is banned in June 1969 in Australia, and it's published the following year on the last day of winter 1970. And it sells like hotcakes. At a time when selling 10,000 copies of a book in paperback in a year is enough to make it a bookseller, to make it a bestseller, Portnoy's Complaint sells 75,000 in 2 weeks. So the print run goes. And there's absolute uproar because Penguin has published this book in secret, unveiled it on one day, and they've done it all over the country. So every single state government, all the police are scrambling to get into bookshops and to seize copies as quickly as they can. And criminal court proceedings begin almost immediately. We have a trial in Victoria, another trial in Western Australia, a trial in the Northern Territory, two failed trials in Tasmania, and then two jury trials in New South Wales. And these play out over the course of a year. And the results of each one of them affect the prospects of the next, because in these court trials, the prosecutors get up and they damn this book and they deride it and they talk about how horrible it is. And the defence witnesses, the defence basically summons all of Australia's literary elite, you know, academics and writers and journalists, to come along and testify to this book's its merit and the fact that it's not going to cause people to become depraved and corrupted. And as time goes on, even though the results in those trials are mixed, the censors begin to look rather foolish, you know. Penguin, for example, was found guilty in the first trial in Victoria, but they were fined only $104.50. When they've sold 75,000 copies of a book, a fine of $104 is not really going to matter that much to them. In Western Australia, the owner of the Communist Party-owned bookshop was found not guilty. And in fact, she'd made so much profit from selling Portnoy's Complaint that she was able to renovate her store. In New South Wales, where the next really crucial trials were held, for the first time they were held before a jury, and a jury could not come to a verdict. They sat and deliberated over this and they couldn't come to a verdict. So the New South Wales government decided it had to hold another trial. It did, and the same thing happened again. So you had this kind of the books available in some states, but not in others. And in other places, you just simply can't get a conviction. And it forced the government, the federal and the state governments, to back down. They realised, we're done. We've been beaten. We've been absolutely codswalloped. We're out, you know. And it was really kind of the big moment in the censorship battles because it forced them to realise that these forces advocating change and reform were not going to go away and that the conversations that were being spurred by Portnoy's Complaint were ones that Australia needed to have, these conversations over autonomy and over freedom and over who should protect who, if anyone. One of the most notable moments, for example, in these trials was when one of the prosecutors got up and read out this horribly scaly passage from Portnoy's Complaint where a woman takes a poop on a table beneath which a man is masturbating. And he says, the prosecutor said, oh, this is disgusting, this is horrible, don't you think, Mr. White? And he's talking to Patrick White, who is about to win the Nobel Prize for Literature in a few weeks' time. And White kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, well, I've heard of worse happening in Sydney, in fact. You know, this kind of nonchalant response that the kind of things they're inviting the jury to condemn already happen. They're just a daily part of life. Other times, things that the prosecutors try to drum up, this kind of condemnation and this kind of damnation, are really quite they're deflected. One of the witnesses, a Professor Harry Heseltine, said on the stand when one of these passages was read to him, he quoted the Roman poet Terence, "Nothing that is human is alien to me." So he was saying, and the argument he proceeded to develop was that literature allows you to have empathy. And allows you to understand and allows you to make connections. And banning a book like this prevents those kinds of connections, prevents that empathy, prevents that understanding, prevents that autonomy that's most sorely needed. And this was drawn upon, in fact, at the end of that trial by the defence counsel, William Dean, who would later become Australia's High Court Justice and Governor General, who said that, you know, We're at a time where young people are being forced to go against their will to fight in Vietnam, and yet we won't allow them to read a book. Surely, if you think it's okay to send a person to go and fight and die for their country potentially, surely you must allow them to read a book. So is this idea and this argument over autonomy and what might happen if you allowed that freedom that was at stake in these court trials. But it was a massive, massive sensation, and it went on for so long. Over a year, and everyone emerged, except for the publisher and the booksellers, with egg on their faces. They looked like fools.
How did you find this story?
I found it after Philip Roth died. Nobody had mentioned it, but the two passing mentions in two newspaper articles. And when I saw it, I thought, my God, this is interesting. This is bizarre. Never heard of it. And so I went up to Sydney and I went through some archives and I found the court transcripts. And as I read them, I thought, I found these fascinating. I found them absolutely intoxicating to read. So many of the issues that we still fight about autonomy, about whether or not people should be censored and who has the right to say what, were leaping out on these pages. And moreover, the story was forgotten. The people involved, the publishers, the booksellers, the academics, though their names were being forgotten, their contribution was being forgotten. I'm an academic, and I often bridle at the suggestion that academics are self-obsessed and kind of live in ivory towers and are aloof and disengaged from the world. This was a moment where that was absolutely not the case, where people, smart people, stood up and did something courageous and did it for the betterment of the country's culture.
How did you unravel it? What was the sort of the source material?
So the big source material was archival work and interviews. Quite a few of the people who were involved in these trials are still alive. Not all of them, certainly. So I travelled around and went and interviewed them, met with them as much as I could, and I went and got the court transcripts for the trials. I also went over to the United Kingdom and got a batch of letters that were sent between the Australian publisher and a British publisher, which narrated and discussed the ins and outs of these trials and the strategies that they were adopting. And which gave me some wonderful stuff, you know, absolutely wonderful stuff. The publishers boasting, for example, when the book was out, about how endemic Portnoy's complaint was now in Australia.
It's a wonderful strategy, isn't it, to have sort of almost military strategy to have planned the dump. And before social media, dare we say, and you know, they were sold in 2 weeks. I was referring back to some of the more high profile ones from the Times in New Zealand, and actually we're comparatively liberal. One that was on my mind was Bullshit and Jelly Beans, written by the now mayor of Invercargill, Tim Shadbolt, when he was a young Auckland University rabble rouser, in a good way. And it was turned down. What happened with that was it was turned down by one of our big publishers, AH and AW Reed, but then Alistair Taylor, who became a rather colourful independent publisher in his own right, published it anyway. No censorship there. Mm-hmm. The Little Red School Book was another one of fame at the time.
Had that as well.
Yes, you did. Banned in France and Italy, banned in the Australian state of Queensland by the Queensland Literature Board of Review in 1972, according to Wiki, but not banned in New Zealand, despite some moral outrage. And the other one that I had in mind was Down Under the Plum Trees, which was more mid-70s, I think, and was basically a sex education book. It got an R18 classification, but again, no ban. So we beat you again.
Well, I'd be happy to say that that's a good thing. That's a good thing in this. I mean, the Little Red School Book is a really interesting example of how fraught these battles became. You know, if you read the Little Red School Book today, you wouldn't really think there's much that's revolutionary in it. It's about, you know, consent and about understanding and about responsibility and about making choices for yourself wisely. And yet it became absolutely contested and controversial everywhere. In Australia, the Australian Prime Minister at the time, Billy McMahon, took the matter to a cabinet meeting, and he was opposed. He wanted to ban the book, and he got up and said, "I've read the first chapter of this thing, and it's disgusting. I don't want it. I think it should be banned. I think it should be removed." And at the time, his hand was actually forced by the fact that the book was in the country, and it was being printed and distributed to schoolchildren by Wendy Bacon, who was a censorship activist who had already defied the government everywhere. But it is this kind of these books that became so fraught and was so controversial.
He was the subject of your other book. I had to Google him. Of course, we get into really interesting political times by about 72, 74 in Australia, probably your most interesting political times, apart from more recent ones. But he was Prime Minister around 71. And why did he grab you to the point where he became the subject of an entire book?
Of Billy McMahon, sorry, or Portnoy's complaint?
No, Billy McMahon.
Largely because nobody had written about him. McMahon was a prime minister, was a minister in Australia for more than 20 years. He was in every single important portfolio in that time. But nobody had ever written about him. And he had made, in that time, been involved in a lot of controversial actions. He was, you know, reputed to have been leaking and to have been manipulating the leadership instability in Australia. And so his story, I thought, was an interesting way to come at and understand this long vista of Australian history. And of course, he was kind of, by the time we get to the 1970s, where Australia is in flux, McMahon is one of those figures who appeared to be holding on with his fingernails against that modernizing and that new in those new forces of social change, which were manifesting really in the Australian Labor Party at this time. So that's why I became interested in McMahon, and it's why I'm so interested in this period. It's such a colourful part of Australia's history.
Thank you, Patrick. Patrick Mullins, the book is The Trials of Port